There's an attempt to keep nonviolent veteran offenders out of Illinois' criminal justice system.
I'm the only judge that deals with this court, so I know everybody personally, too. So it's almost like having my kids out there, if you know what I mean. So that, and that's kind of the approach I take to it, actually. It's providing some structure, some discipline, and at the same time, trying to be caring and understanding their problem.
That's Judge Richard Tognarelli speaking to the Belleville News Democrat in Southern Illinois. We'll talk to him about veterans' treatment courts and the push to make them mandatory in the state. Also, why a university researcher is suing the federal government before they can prosecute him as a hacker. And classes begin today at Peoria's private university, Bradley.
We had more applications this year, like 9,700, which is more than any we've ever had in our history.
We speak with its new president, Gary Roberts. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Maybe you've heard of drug courts, a judicial process that's designed to keep people out of the criminal justice system. It involves regular hearings with a judge, court appearances, things like mandatory attendance at treatment sessions, and frequent and random testing for substance abuse. Well, today we're talking about veterans courts. They're specially formed for military veterans who are facing nonviolent crimes. The first one was established in Buffalo, New York in 2008. Today, there are 350 veteran courts in at least 32 states. And there's a bill sitting at Governor Rauner's desk right now that would require chief justices in each judicial circuit to establish veterans court programs in their circuit instead of just authorizing them to establish them. Madison County was the first in Illinois to start a veterans court in 2009. With us on the phone now is Madison County Circuit Court Judge Richard Tognarelli, who runs the veterans court now. He joins us from Edwardsville near St. Louis. Judge Tognarelli, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for taking the time to be with us this morning.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me on this morning.
Can you tell us about what a typical case is like in veterans court? Can you maybe give me an example of who would be in front of you?
Well, in your introduction, you first described the drug court and the drug court, the purpose of the drug court. The veterans court is a hybrid of that drug court. What we see, what I see most frequently today are veterans from returning from Afghanistan, some from Iraq. We do have veterans from as far back as Vietnam and Korea, but mostly what we see are veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq who have either or suffer from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, they have psychological problems or substance abuse problems. What's different with the drug court than the veterans court is our court is open to quite a few more charges than drug court. So we see a lot of DUI, driving under the influence charges. We do see some drug possession charges. We do see some domestic cases, some violence. So it's a little bit different than drug court, but And I don't know if you wanted me to go into the procedure exactly on how we get to see them.
Yeah, how is it different? I guess how is it different from a regular court case? Because you have you do this as part of your work as a judge. You see both. You have both the veterans court and your regular court work. So how would it be different?
Actually, the initial charges would be the same. I would see them the veteran as a defendant in any other case, but we determine we have a questionnaire when we do first see the defendants, and we find out whether or not they are a veteran. Number one, if they are a veteran, then they're referred to our probation department to do a screening to determine if they qualify for veterans benefits, if they've been honorably discharged, and then they're screened by our probation department and then referred to the state's attorney's office, and that's pretty much how I get to see them. So they're taken off of the regular docket if they are screened and found eligible, and they're placed into our veterans court, and they are we have regular staffings. We try to determine a treatment plan for the veteran. We monitor the treatment. Initially, they come into court every 2 weeks on a Wednesday afternoon. We monitor them, make sure that they're getting the treatment. When we feel that they have successfully completed their treatment, then we would graduate them. So there's no, even though we might place someone on 12 months probation or 24 months probation, if they have not completed the treatment, then we would extend that until we're satisfied that they've got in, accomplished the goals that we set in our initial staffing. So,
and when you said eligible, Judge, I wonder what did make someone eligible to participate in this?
They have to be honorably discharged or discharged with general under honorable conditions, and they need to have VA benefits. But primarily, we're looking at the discharge.
Mm-hmm. And how did you
initially,
first? Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Judge.
I was going to say initially when we started, it was only seeing combat veterans, but now we opened it up to any veteran that has been honorably discharged.
And how did you first get involved with the Veterans Court?
I grew up, I'm just, I guess, explaining that. I was the presiding judge in drug court and mental health court. So when the Judge Charles Romani started this court in March of 2009, when he retired in 2012, then I stepped up and did the Veterans Court. So I really enjoyed my experience in the drug court, so it was kind of a natural progression for me on the reassignment. I'm also an Air Force reservist, so the veterans are near and dear to my heart also.
Right, and as being a veteran, I wonder how that perspective informs your judicial work, particularly in this Veterans Court, but I imagine in your other court work as well.
Well, again, you know, you do have you feel a little closer to the veteran having been involved in that environment. You know what they've given up in order to take care of us and sacrifice for us. So I do think they're entitled to the special treatment that we give them. And when I say special treatment, if they successfully complete our program, they can have their charge dismissed, which, going back to what you asked me earlier, which is much different, obviously, than the regular defendant I see. On the other hand, in order to complete our program, there are numerous hoops that they have to jump through as well as completing the treatment that we set forth.
Yeah, what are those hoops, Judge? Can you explain a little bit more about what they have to do?
Again, they come to court every 2 weeks for progress reports to see how they're doing. If they have drug treatment, they may be going daily. They may be going every other day to treatment, 2 or 3 hours a day for drug treatment. We have people that are going for psychological treatment, so they go to the VA hospitals. We're very blessed here to have two VA hospitals within 15 miles of the court. And so we also monitor, for example, their appointments with medical providers. I have a liaison, an employee of the Veterans Administration that sits next to me in court. So that if a person comes in and tells me, well, they've been to the doctor, I ask them what the treatment's been, whether they went to their appointment, whether they went to their group therapy, and I can verify that immediately because I have we have access to their medical records through the VA, so we verify that immediately. So we monitor treatment. Again, it could be daily, it could be a couple times a week, it could be once a month. We also have, we're fortunate that the VA assists us, and we have a group therapy that we provide at the courthouse on Wednesdays. And we also have what's called Smart Recovery, which is analogous to AA groups that we also have at our own courthouse that the VA or the Vet Center provides to us, and we have that available here at our courthouse on Thursday. So, any veteran that's involved in our court must attend or go to these groups, must go to their doctor's appointments, must take the medicine or prescriptions that are prescribed. We monitor all that. We also do random drug tests. So
it's a pretty strict regimen, it sounds like. What happens, Judge,
exactly.
What happens if someone doesn't follow that?
Well, I will tell you, my experience has been that, you know, the veterans, as compared to my experience in the drug court, I don't see as many veterans that do not follow the protocol. But for those that do, for example, we've had those where they've come in with a dirty drop, a bad urinalysis report. Our court is based on honesty and trust. If a vet comes before me and says he hasn't used any drugs, and then we do this random test either before or after court on the same day, and I'm told then that they failed their drug test, I may send the vet over for a day over at the county jail. I may send him for 2 weeks in the county jail until we can see him again. If we have not seen a veteran, if he doesn't show up in court, he hasn't been to treatment, we issue a warrant and have the sheriff pick him up. And again, he might sit in jail for a while, a week or two, until we can get him back on track. Since I've taken over the court in 2012, I guess there's been two or three veterans that we've discharged from the program, and most of those have been voluntary. So, the success rate in the veterans court is much higher than it is in the drug and mental health court.
That's Madison County Circuit Court Judge Richard Tognarelli. I want to bring someone else into this conversation, State Senator Scott Bennett. He's a Democrat he represents parts of Champaign and Vermilion counties, and he's co-sponsor of that bill that we were talking about at the beginning of the hour. Senator Bennett, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us as well.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
I wonder, did your support of the bill have anything to do with your previous experience before you were state senator as an assistant state's attorney, your experience in the criminal justice system prior?
It absolutely did. Prior to becoming a state senator, I served as an assistant state's attorney in First Champaign and also McLean County. In both of those situations, I dealt with alternative courts. In one of those instances, I was the state's attorney's representative to the drug court and saw the success and the different approach that these alternative courts bring to the criminal justice system and saw that there was an obvious need to expand that to veterans around the state.
Now, you worked, both houses passed a bill that is at Governor Rauner's desk right now, waiting for him to sign. Can you explain a little bit more about what you all would like to see with these veterans courts throughout the state of Illinois and not just as we're hearing about what happens in Madison County?
Well, regarding HB 5003, bill that I was a co-sponsor of, I have a little update on that. The governor did sign that just recently, and so it will go into effect on January 1st of 2018. But what the goal of that is going to be is that out of 102 counties, only 12 have any semblance of a veterans court. Over the last decade, you've seen more and more counties, even smaller counties, buying into and understanding the concept of drug courts or mental health courts. And they've seen, certainly there was some resistance, I think, to this new way of thinking for criminal justice. And so now what we're trying to do is really encourage all counties, all 102 counties to take on some semblance of a veterans court. But what this bill would do is simply say each chief judge in each circuit would be required to establish a program. And the idea there is some local control. There are some circuits that can understand their needs better than others. There are multiple veterans courts, for example, in Cook County. And then there are huge areas of the state that actually have a large amount of veterans in them, but yet have no available veterans courts. And so this is trying to bring some consistency throughout the state and try to, put the deadline off a little bit, give them the time to establish and develop these programs, but still tell them that, we think as a state, this is a direction in which we need to be moving.
Senator Bennett, we were hearing Judge Tognarelli talk about all of the different resources. It sounds like, and certainly the program in Madison County is well established. It's been around for some time. but, you know, having folks from the VA who are very involved in this process, the different support groups that are there on Wednesdays and Thursdays, it sounds like there's an entire network that's been established in Edwardsville for veterans. Is that something that you would like to see throughout the state? Is that too resource intensive? What, I mean, it seems like there's a lot of people who are involved in getting this going and at least how it exists in Madison County.
There's no question that Madison County is the model for the whole state. And so while I'm on the phone, I guess I should thank the judge for his work there. And I know many other people's work there. They, you know, certainly are the gold standard of the Veterans Court. But we need to recognize, and this has been also true of drug court and other alternative court, these systems allow individual circuits and individual counties to kind of put their own slant on it and own approach. There are certainly best practices we should follow, but they can really kind of tailor it to their own special needs. A very small county may want to work with a county next door on how they're going to do it or how they're going to monitor. Some of these tests are very expensive, so certainly technologies bring that cost down over time. But you know, we in Champaign County, where my district in Vermilion County, we have a VA hospital, so we know that we're going to have more resources than an area that doesn't have that. But the idea is that the circuit judges can help kind of put together a plan where they can work with the resources they have and resources nearby to get something that's good for the whole state.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Senator Scott Bennett and with Madison County Circuit Court Judge Richard Tognarelli about veterans courts throughout Illinois. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st and tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about a new law that would take effect across Illinois starting in January, requiring veterans courts all across the state of Illinois, similar to the way drug courts work, an alternative treatment to keep people out of the criminal justice system. On the line with me from Edwardsville is Madison County Circuit Court Judge Richard Tognarelli. He leads a veterans court there, a well-established program that has started way back in 2009. Also on the line with us, Champaign State Senator Scott Bennett. He represents Champaign, Urbana, parts of Champaign County and Vermilion County, was one of the co-sponsors of this bill. Senator Bennett, I just wanted to ask you, as we're talking about just sort of this whole notion of these alternative treatment courts, you were talking about your previous experience as an assistant state's attorney. Do you think that paving the way and having this sort of work and alternative treatment for veterans, do you think that might also have an impact later on drug courts or thinking about sort of just alternative ways of keeping people out of the criminal justice system and kind of dealing with things in a different way?
Absolutely. I mean, what you've seen in recent years is a shift, recognizing that we can't continue the way we're going. You can't continue to put as many people in the criminal justice system as we currently have with the current funds we have available for it in the state of Illinois. And so the idea is let's try to actually address the causes of the criminal behavior and address that rather than just solely deal with it on the punishment side. So if it's a mental health issue, let's actually address that. And the same is true with substance abuse. What we recognize is with veterans, there are additional resources out there. We just have to identify them as veterans and put them in touch with people that can help us in local VAs and others. And so I think the same thing could be true, and we can extend that to the drug court and mental health court, as in particular the state reduces its available resources. It's so much more important that we identify these issues and put them in with the experts where they might say, we may not have as many mental health facilities as we did 10 years ago, but we need someone who recognizes the resources that are available and make those available to a person when that behavior brings them in the criminal justice system. So I think it's just a matter of, you know, recognizing one size doesn't always fit all in these cases, but you do need experts in these fields to identify the problem and to know what resources are available. That's more important now than ever.
Judge Tognarelli, I'm wondering about what you all have developed in Madison County. Certainly this is something that you all have worked on for some time, and this program has developed over years. I wanted to ask, first of all, how much resources does it take for you all as a court? You mentioned before that you work with, you have someone from the VA who sits with you, you have a liaison. How many folks are working on this veterans court with you?
I have a probation officer who's dedicated to the veterans court, an assistant state's attorney that's dedicated, a public defender. We have, again, the VA liaison. We get cooperation from our sheriff's department, from the community. So, those are the people I guess I deal with on a direct basis almost daily.
And did you convene, did you as judge in the circuit court, were you and your predecessor before you who founded the court, were you guys the ones sort of responsible for bringing all of those parties together?
We were. Judge Romani and Judge Callis, who was our chief judge at the time, did bring the parties together and sat down and worked and put this veterans treatment court together. Judge Romani had met Judge Russell, who started the veterans court program in Buffalo, New York. So they were good friends. So that helped. Also.
I also wonder, Judge Tognarelli, with you being a veteran yourself, I wonder if that also helps the proceedings when you're working with all of the folks who are coming before you. If that you said something originally that I want to come back to, which is that your court is based on honesty and trust. And I wonder how much that trust is a little bit easier because they know that you have also served in the military.
I absolutely agree with you. I think it is extremely important. When Judge Romani and Judge Callis started this court back in 2009, every participant was a veteran. Our state's attorney was a Marine. Our public defender assistant was a Navy vet. Our probation officer was an Army vet. So everyone that was in the court on a regular basis was a veteran. I do think that helps. I don't think that's a necessity. In fact, our current the probation officer is not a veteran. But I do think it takes a special person, a special mentality, a person who can relate to these veterans. I don't think it's as important that it be a veteran, but I certainly think it helps.
And what advice do you have for other circuit courts? Right now there's 12 court programs in Illinois. As we were talking about with this new law in January, there'll be some sort of protocol established throughout the state. What advice do you have for other circuit courts who will be establishing this for the first time?
Again, I would say don't be afraid. Speaking as a judge, I would say that this assignment has been one of the most satisfying assignments that I've had in 15 years being on the bench. Just to watch the progress that these people take, the fact that we can keep them out of jail, that we can keep them from reoffending, and I congratulate the senator for sponsoring this bill. We're saving tons and tons of taxpayer money by keeping people out of prison. We can get people through these programs, with a cost less than $5,000, certainly no greater than $7,500, as opposed to sending someone to prison and spending $30,000 a year to house them in a prison. I do realize, and Senator Bennett touched on this, we are fortunate here in Madison County because we're only 15 miles away from VA facilities. Not everyone in the state will be so fortunate. It sounds like you have VA hospitals there in Champaign, Urbana. That certainly makes our job much, much easier. Right now, we assist some other counties that are nearby and adjoining, and even though they are not in our system, their cases are not in our system, we still monitor them. We accept them into our veterans court just because of our proximity to the VA hospital. So the logistics there may be difficult, But if there are any judges or folks out there that have some questions or want to know what to do, certainly my door is open. And again, I certainly congratulate Senator Bennett for sponsoring this bill.
That's Madison.
I know it scares people.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you taking the time. Madison County Circuit Court Judge Richard Tognarelli talking to us about the Veterans Court there. I also want to thank State Senator Scott Bennett. He's a Democrat. He represents parts of Champaign and Vermilion County. Gentlemen, thank you for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Christian Sandvig is suing the federal government. He's a researcher at the University of Michigan. Part of his job involves studying the internet. That means he writes computer code that collects information online, and that, he says, opens him and many others up to prosecution under a federal law against hacking. Sandvig is a professor at the University of Michigan School of Information. He spent a couple of years teaching at the University of Illinois before that. One of the other four people on this lawsuit teaches at the U of I. In an interest of full disclosure, by the way, the lawsuit is not just on behalf of researchers, but journalists. Christian joins us now by phone from the University of Michigan. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
In late June, you filed this lawsuit through the ACLU, and I want to ask you about that. But first, I think we need to get a sense of what we're talking about. You do a lot of research online. One of the projects that led to this moment was your work on Facebook. What were you looking for, and how did you get this information?
Well, Facebook, you know, is a part of everybody's everyday experience, and it's now a primary way that people find out what's going on in the world. And so I'm a social researcher, so I'm interested in human behavior, although I'm also a computer programmer. And, you know, we wanted to know more about how people were using Facebook, particularly the Facebook news feed. So the news feed picks things for you to look at. And I don't know if you've used Facebook recently, but a lot of users are a little bit confused as to how it does so. When you see something on Facebook, it's not really clear why you see that.
And sure, how it ends up in your feed, right.
Yeah, right. And so that was a question we were really interested in figuring out. How do people think about the news feed? How does the news feed work? And the implications are huge.
Right, and certainly Facebook isn't being really transparent about the algorithms that they use to figure out what ends up in people's feeds, right?
Yeah, and that's true of all internet platforms. I mean, it's not the case where you can just look up the answer to a question like, why did Google give me this search result and not some other result?
And so what happened with you looking for this research?
Well, we decided that this was joint work with a number of researchers, and the lead researcher was a doctoral student, Madahari Eslami. And in that work, we sat around and tried to figure out how we could do it following all the rules. I don't know what your impressions of professors are, but I mean, we're generally pretty staid. We're pretty, you know, law-abiding.
So really? Okay.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a fair generalization. So we looked up sort of what are the rules for how we could use Facebook's information, and Facebook wrote those rules itself, and it had some called an application programming interface, which tells you how to write software that will ask Facebook questions for research or other purposes. And we really struggled with it. It was really a challenge to figure out how to do the research within the rules set by Facebook. And we managed to do it, and the research was a really interesting study, and we were happy with the result. But then after the study was completed, the rules changed. I'm not exactly sure why, and I don't think they had to do with my study. They just change all the time. And so now that research is impossible.
You're talking about Facebook's terms of service, but there's also federal law regarding this, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, right?
Yeah, and one of the reasons we wanted to be so careful to follow the terms of service is that the U.S. has this anti-hacking law that's been called the worst law about the internet that's ever been written. I mean, it's a really strict and severe law with huge penalties. And lately it's been interpreted to mean that if you break the terms of service for a website or an online platform, you might be prosecuted for committing a felony.
And this concern isn't just hypothetical. There have been real-world cases where people have been prosecuted.
Absolutely. I mean, the most famous is someone named Aaron Schwartz. He was a fellow at the Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University, and he was interested in downloading research articles from, I believe it was Elsevier.
Right.
And he had access. So, remember, this is an anti-hacking law, right? So he had access
already. Right, these were publicly available online.
I think you needed to have, a login or permission through your university.
Mm-hmm. And he did use his university login for that, correct?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right. So he had permission, and then what he wanted to do is he thought it was wrong that so much knowledge was behind paywalls, and he wanted to see how much he could download, and so he broke a rule about how much you can download in a period of time, like how many downloads per day. So that's the rule that he broke. And he also wrote a script, although it's not a complicated thing at all, not what you're thinking of, like breaking passwords and Matthew Broderick in the movie War Games. It's nothing like that. It's just a very, very simple script. But there was a big overreaction at MIT where he did it, and they ended up calling the feds. He got arrested, and then prosecutors, it's a long story, but prosecutors charged him with a hacking law and threatened him with 50 years in prison, and he hung himself.
Yeah, it's a really sad story. Aaron Schwartz, Reddit co-founder, right? Actually, Highland Park native from Chicago. He grew up in, and I think his father is still in the Chicago area. So that, I wonder if you could then take us to your lawsuit, Christian. You filed it, Sandvig versus Lynch, for Attorney General Loretta Lynch?
That's right.
Why is that?
Well, it's just the form of lawsuits against the federal government. I mean, what we're trying to do is object to a particular part of the anti-hacking law that says you can't use a computer in a way that is not authorized. And that's the part that we find is really objectionable for journalists and researchers because, I mean, I don't know, have you ever played solitaire at work? That's using a computer in a way that is not authorized.
Right. And when you read the law, it makes it illegal to do things like you talked about, access a protected computer without authorization, this intent to defraud. We're going to tweet out link to the full language so everyone can see it if you follow 21st. I wanted to ask, it's also, I think the law was intended to make it illegal to defraud or gain unauthorized access to protected computers. But your contention is that the law is so much more far-reaching than that.
Yeah, I mean, it was actually, the story is that President Ronald Reagan screened the movie War Games in the screening room of the White House. And he liked the movie and was terrified by the idea of Matthew Broderick launching a nuclear war as a teenager.
So is that how old this law is?
That's right.
Okay.
And, I mean, maybe that would be a reasonable concern, except that War Games was science fiction. You know, remember the computer was sentient.
It was also like 30 years ago, right? Or
right.
More than that. Yeah.
But, you know, at the time, maybe a law about computers could be different than a law not about computers, and that would be fine. But as the years have gone by, we now use computers for everything. So at the time, they said, we're just going to have to really write a strict law about hacking because we want to really just have it really, really safe from any tampering. But now it's ridiculous. I mean, 50 years for breaking a downloading too many articles clause, that's crazy. I mean, you could just go in and steal the articles and beat up a librarian while you're at it, and you'd probably do better just because it's not using a computer, because it's in the physical world.
We're going to have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Christian Sandvig. He's a professor and researcher at the University of Michigan, suing the federal government. He's explaining that lawsuit, being represented by the ACLU. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is The 21st. We're talking about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act with Christian Sandvig. He's actually suing the federal government. He's a professor at the University of Michigan, their School of Information. We've been talking about this law and how it affects researchers, journalists, basically anybody who's looking for information online. Christian, we were talking before the break about this law You were saying it was originally created by President Reagan. I know there's been efforts to redo the law, including one proposal that was named Aaron's Law after Aaron Swartz. Again, our previous conversation we just had before the break. Has that gone anywhere?
I mean, I think it's been a struggle. I'm not involved in that particularly, but I'm a big fan of the reform. I mean, I think it's been a struggle because the way the law is written now, all the power is given to the prosecutors, the federal government, and to the companies that run internet sites and computer networks. And so those are people who aren't that interested in changing the law. Their argument is, look, just trust us. It's broad, but we're not going to do anything crazy with it, so just leave it alone.
And what do you hope to do with your lawsuit?
I mean, what we're hoping to do specifically is to get a ruling that will allow researchers and journalists to look things up online without fear of this particular unauthorized or not authorized use provision, which is currently scaring a lot of us.
Well, and some of your research is on issues related to discrimination. How has the internet changed that kind of research? Can you give me an example?
Sure. I mean, you know, discrimination is a really interesting case to think about in terms of social research and the internet, because one of the big tools we used to use when we were studying discrimination, for example, gender discrimination or discrimination on the basis of race, one of the tools we used to use is that we would look at public information and we would sometimes ask employers and real estate agents or landlords questions. So, for example, a really good research design to see if there is racial discrimination in housing would be, I send two people to a landlord, one white and one black, at about the same time, and I ask if there are any vacancies. And if the black person gets a different answer than the white person, that's a problem. So this is just the kind of research that's been done going back to the 1970s by social researchers to study discrimination. So the funny thing about today is that if I were to try to do something like that, I mean, we know that finding a job and finding housing is now online. Everything's online, right? And so the fact is that now I'm violating the terms of service of any website if I were to ask them a question that would have been totally okay in the physical world.
Mm-hmm. Where does the case stand? Are there developments coming up that people should watch for?
Well, that's a question for my lawyer, but we're really hoping for some news soon.
All right. We've tweeted out all of the information about Christian's lawsuit, including a blog post he wrote that was entitled Why I'm Suing the Federal Government, which has more information about all of this, including terms of service. I want to thank Christian Sandvig. He's a professor at the University of Michigan School of Information, specializing in the design of internet infrastructure and social computing. Thanks for being with us, Christian.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
About 1,100 freshmen begin school today at Bradley University in Peoria. That's a 15% increase for the freshman class compared to last fall. It's also the first fall start for Gary Roberts, who's 7 months into his job running the private university. He joins us now from our partner station, WCBU in Peoria. President Roberts, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You're starting this year, as I mentioned, with a 15% increase in your freshman class for students. How does that fit in with your enrollment goals?
Yeah, actually, I thought it was about 17%, but we'll take whatever we can get. This exceeded our expectations, actually. We were, for the last 2 years, our freshman classes have been under 950. I think last year it was like 925 or something like that. So we were targeting a significant increase for this year. But we had no idea we were going to do as well as we did. We ideally get between 1050 and 1100. That's our financially optimal range. And anywhere in that range, we're happy with. And we have hit the top end of that range this year. So we're very excited. And it's changed the conversation significantly here going forward.
How has it changed things?
Well, when you're looking at classes of 950 and less, that's not sustainable financially long term. So if we were going to continue with that size freshman class, we would have to be looking at restructuring, which is a fancy way of saying layoffs and program cuts and whatever. This changes that conversation. We're now very confident that we've turn things around, that Bradley's brand is very strong. We had more applications this year, like 9,700, which is more than any we've ever had in our history. We've had an extremely positive response. We've branched into some new markets down in Texas and elsewhere, and so we're pretty confident now that we can be financially viable with our entering freshman classes going forward. So for a couple of years, we're going to have slight deficits because those two small classes are going to take a couple of years to work their way through the system. But we're not planning on cutting, laying people off, doing anything that would cut into the meat of our programs. We're just going to absorb a couple of years of small deficits, and then we're optimistic about running some surpluses going into the indefinite future.
And, of course, that's such a different picture than we're hearing for the state university system. And there's been so much a focus on the public schools throughout the state and the lack of funding for the past year, and now uncertainty for those state universities about the second half of the year. I wonder, do you think that affected your enrollment numbers and maybe helped you all, if that kind of helped, if you've heard from students anecdotally or if that influenced decisions? Maybe you're a more stable option for people now?
We have no evidence that it helped us, but there is a kind of an instinct that the chaos that was going on in the public universities may have caused some students who might have thought about going to the University of Illinois, for example, to say, I'm just not going to invest in that kind of cauldron. We'll go to the public schools. We do know from some anecdotal evidence and some data that there were a significant number of Illinois students who are going to Indiana University, to Iowa, to Iowa State. So we do know that some of the state universities in the neighboring states have seen a significant uptick in Illinois students attending there. So we think the chaos in the state schools here have directly benefited state schools in neighboring states. We really don't know whether or not it's helped the private schools like Bradley any or not. It couldn't have hurt us, that's for sure.
So as you're talking about this, the Peoria Journal-Star reported that there were about 1,000 students at Bradley that received MAP grant funding at an average of about $4,000 a year. Did you all continue to fund MAP grants throughout the budget standoff?
And the students who had MAP grants as part of their overall financial aid package still owed that money to the university, but we didn't hit them up for it. I mean, we allowed them to continue to owe it on the assumption that the state would eventually come through. And then for this past academic year, the state did come through. So the students were not affected by it other than their anxiety levels were increased. But yes, basically, we did not ask the students for that money, which I guess is a way of saying we funded it.
Right. Certainly other schools like Illinois, IIT, there were other schools that asked the students to pay for that up front, and that caused some anxiety at other schools throughout Illinois. So that's why I was asking about your student population. But, you know, when you think about the MAP grant funding, I know that most recipients of MAP grants, not just at Bradley, but at other schools, are first-generation students, college students, or students of color. And I wonder if you felt like how you feel like you're doing on your ability to recruit and retain a diverse student population as people are thinking more about the costs of college and sort of weighing all of those decisions.
Our entering freshman class this year has over 26% students from disadvantaged populations. So that was a significant increase. I think we were only about 19% last year. So we saw a significant increase in those students who are adding to the diversity of our student body. So we're pretty confident that we've got a good product here and that we can bring in students of color and students who are first generation in their families and all the other groups that we worry about missing out. So we're not worried about that. Let's put it that way.
Well, and I noticed that the biggest increase you all saw in international students were for students from India. Is that something you all were actively recruiting for?
Well, we saw a big increase in students from India for our master's program in the engineering college. There was not a significant increase in Indian students in our undergraduate population, which is, of course, our primary student population. But we did see a number of students from India going into our master's in engineering programs. And India is a place where our graduate school, Dean Jeff Bakken, has been recruiting. And so that's to be expected, I guess.
We're speaking with Gary Roberts, who's the president of Bradley University in Peoria. And I was wondering about you in terms of your background. I know you were just mentioning the dean of one of the graduate programs. I know you previously were dean of the law school at Indiana University. You held similar positions at Tulane. You're in your first 7 months here as president of Bradley University. Given that vantage point you have of your past experiences, what's it like now to serve as president of a university?
Well, it's exciting. I've been on major campuses before, so I've been exposed to undergraduate education and to a very complex universities with several different colleges. So I'm not unfamiliar with other disciplines besides law, but it is a new experience and it really is exciting and it's fun and I'm just having a great time.
What do you think you've learned the most in these first 7 months?
Well, I'm not sure I could pinpoint any one particular thing. I'm just getting to know the people. I'm getting to understand the challenges that the different disciplines face and, just the whole range of issues that Bradley has to deal with. We've got great people. We've got great programs. We've got a very ambitious a building project facing us over the next couple of years. And so I'm learning all about how you have to put funding packages together to get buildings built and facilities taken care of. I'm learning about police departments. I'm learning about undergraduate admissions offices. I'm learning about student services and all the range of things we have to do with undergraduates, from counseling to recreation to intercollegiate athletics. So it's just a panoply of things that I didn't have to deal with before that I'm dealing with now, but it's all exciting and fun.
I know this afternoon I understand you're going to be adding another title to your resume, which is ice cream taster. And I wonder what you can tell us about Mrs. Bradley's birthday ice cream blend that's being created in honor of the 200th anniversary of the Bradley University's, or the 200th birthday of Bradley University's founder, Lydia Moss Bradley.
I don't know much about the ice cream. I'm going to find that out at 2 o'clock this afternoon. I hear it's vanilla with red velvet swirls through it or whatever. It sounds certainly good. I'm an ice creamaholic, so this is right up my alley. But, when I was a student here, I knew Lydia Moss Bradley founded the university, but I paid no attention to that fact. And it's only been since I've been president that I've really started to focus on her. She was an incredible woman, a remarkable life. The richest woman in the United States at the time, the first woman to serve on a bank board in the United States. So, woman who made her second husband sign a prenuptial agreement at a time when nobody knew what those were. And she was so philanthropic, founding, homes for orphans and elderly sick people. And, of course, Bradley University. She started our park district here in Peoria by donating huge amounts of land that are still our parks here. She was just a fabulous woman, and we want to highlight that fact going forward here this year on the occasion of her 200th birthday.
Gary Roberts is the president of Bradley University in Peoria, joining us from our partner station, WCBU. Enjoy the ice cream.
You can bet I will.
That's all the time we have for today. On Friday's show, we're going to be talking about retirement. And we wanted to ask those of you who are already retired and listening to the program, are there things you wish you had done differently, whether we're talking about in your career, life, or finances? Do you want to give some advice to other people? Leave us a voicemail. Our phone number is 217-300-2121. Again, that's 217-300-2121. We're going to be talking about retirement regrets or not on Friday. We've also got a Facebook post up, by the way. If you like the 21st on Facebook, you can put your comments there. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, every other way to contact us, that phone number again, email, social media, it's all at our website at www.21stshow.org. We're produced by Christine Herman, Philip Kusabika, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.